Welcome to the Fit 40 podcast, where we take all the confusing, conflicting fitness and nutrition information and break it down so that you can live your healthiest, strongest, most energized life. I'm your host, Brian Fitzsimmons. Let's get it started. What's up, everybody? Welcome back for another awesome episode. We have an incredible guest this week, Rachel Tretta. She is a certified physical therapist, women's fitness specialist, fitness nutrition specialist. She's been featured in Women's Health, HuffPost, PopSugar, Well and Good, Slate, and Peloton. She also happens to be a mom, a writer, and a long-term weight loss success story herself. So no doubt she's going to drop a lot of really good tips for you guys. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be on here, Brian.
Happy to have you. So before we get into, I know we wanted to really cover the big one, which would be like calories, counting them, not counting them, nutritional strategies and things like that. But before we get into that, I'd love to know a little bit about your story, because I'm sure that somebody listening probably started from a similar spot and would really benefit from hearing how you got into fitness, nutrition, and like you said, your weight loss story, how it's been like a long-term success. Where did that start?
Yeah, it's interesting in terms of, you know, talking about my story first, because as we get into the calorie discussion and the macro discussion that we're going to talk about, a lot of what I work on with clients and a lot of what my own journey has been shaped around is that long-term maintenance, because, you know, I lost weight a long time ago and I've kept it off. And that's ultimately, I think, what everyone wants is to lose weight and keep it off, not just lose weight. So my own story starts more than 10 years ago. I grew up in the deep South in the 90s. So, you know, I don't think that the South is famous for its health food scene. I definitely grew up with, you know, a lot of processed food and a lot of very rich and very fried food. And for me, it was just normal. Like, that was the way people ate. It was a big part of my food culture. And also, on the flip side, I wasn't really encouraged to exercise either. I don't think that's necessarily true for everyone from my background, but for myself and my personality, I was definitely like the mathlete, not the athlete. You know, I was that kid. Like, I did quiz bowl, I did choir. I was not an organized sport. So I
quiz
didn't
bowl.
Really...
That's a new one. Yeah. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, like if anyone's seen like the original Mean Girls, whenever she's the team, like that was my team. So so like from both sides of the equation in terms of either nutrition or exercise, I wasn't very well set up. And, you know, something that I talk about with people now, but it's really true for me at the time, is that you do get bought into an identity in terms of like what your exercise and your eating says about you and like who you are as a person. And for me, I was very heavily invested in being like the smart kid or like the girl who wasn't trying too hard. And, you know, and then as I got older, like the woman who wasn't trying too hard. You know, I wanted to be like cool about food and, you know, not obsessing about my weight. And that was something that was really important to me. And I think for me, it started to backfire when the actual like health and weight issues started really catching up once I got out of my teens and into my 20s, where I actually at one point just stopped weighing myself, because once the scale hit a certain point, and I know there's people who relate to this, you know, it's still going up, but you just can't look at it. You know, you just can't come to terms with what's happening. And for me, the catalyst for change was in my early 20s, I went on an international trip for a month. And a month is not like a super long time, but if you're like eating hard, it is enough time to like make some, you know, negative changes. And it is such like a crystal clear memory to me that I knew I had gained weight because I had to like buy new clothes and stuff like that. And I came back and my then boyfriend, now husband, opened the door for the first time, like whenever I came back. And when he saw me, it was like he couldn't conceal it, that like a look of shock went across his face. And it wasn't unkind, but it was just that instinctive like, whoa, moment of like, you look really different. And that was such a change moment for me, where it was like a breakthrough of you know, what I am doing to myself is not okay. I am not going in a good direction. And even though now, like, I coach that your healthy weight may not always line up with a BMI chart and what a BMI chart says is a healthy weight, I still think everyone has a healthy range where they're going to be optimal and where they're going to thrive. And for me, like, I was way out of that range at that point. And I think when you have those decision moments, you can either put your head in the sand and just double down. And sometimes people do that where it's, you do have a moment of clarity, but then you just don't do anything. But for me, that was really a breakthrough moment where I did start changing things that summer. And, you know, partly because I was in my early 20s, the weight did just melt off. It came off so quickly. And I lost about 50 pounds. And what I like to tell people now is that, you know, it wasn't just about weight, you know, it is about like that inner transformation of my identity where I was open to questioning, you know, is it okay to basically like abuse yourself with food and with lack of self-care just because you don't want to be the person who's trying too hard, you know, or that you don't want to seem like you care about what you look like and things like that. So it was a really, really big change for me. And then, you know, obviously that sparked my interest in health and fitness. Later, I ended up career switching from teaching to full-time personal training and lived in New York City, had a fully booked out in-person, in-home training business. And then the evolution gradually began to online. And, you know, we can go more into that story as well. But basically, COVID pushed me fully online in terms of a business transition. And honestly, like, I've never looked back. I absolutely love online coaching.
Yeah, there was so many good things in there that I cannot wait to dive into a little bit more. Because one of the big things that I tell a lot of people that listen to this podcast is that these are the people that we want to listen to because they're trainers that have actually been in the trenches, that have actually done the work, mm-hmm. not some people that got a cert and decided to go online immediately. And they're like, I train people now. So mm-hmm. you actually like know the details of like what goes into actually training people and getting mm-hmm. results over a long mm-hmm. period of time, which yes. is something that's becoming more and more rare, it seems like. Yes. So I'm glad that we've got that, because another thing that you brought up that I found really interesting is it's almost like when you said your husband saw you and gave you that look, it was that moment of not shaming, but just honesty of like something's different. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of people mix up honesty versus like body shaming themselves. Mm-hmm. So what's your perspective on that, with what is like the right way to navigate those waters of let's call a spade, but let's not beat ourselves up?
Right. I mean, that's a great question. And I think it honestly is going to be different too for people with different personalities. And I think that for me in general, a lot of it has to do with language in terms of, you know, what you want to be cultivating is care for your body. And I think my philosophy, I think that care comes from a place of self-acceptance and more of a space of body neutrality. And that when people use shame-based language, they are often setting themselves up for it to backfire, because often when people have negative feelings, if their main soothing mechanism or emotional self-regulation is that like caving in to lethargy and food and TV or going out or whatever it is, that's how they're going to deal with negative feelings. So for me, I really encourage people, you want to be feeling as positive or at least as neutral as possible. And I think a lot of that starts from language in terms of like not over focusing on certain body parts. And that's a big thing I see with women, is you're not looking at the big picture of your overall body composition and your overall fitness. You're really focusing on a certain feature or a certain characteristic that you want to change, like it's like plastic surgery. And on top of that, you're being super negative about it. Like the language and the nicknames you're using are not helping you, because, you know, you were saying like calling a spade, it's like, it's not that, you know, you may never lose that characteristic if you lose weight. And then how do you judge whether or not you were successful? So I think a lot of it starts with just not coming from a shame-based place with language, being a little bit more body neutral, and working with a coach really helps, assuming it's like a compassionate, you know, more comprehensive type of coach who's like a good human, you know, but will help you zoom out and have that external set of eyeballs to give you perspective.
Exactly. We know exactly who you're talking about when it comes to the type of coach, because those drill sergeants, everybody seems to want one, but that's usually where this negativity comes from.
You want it, like, but you don't.
It's a little bit of both, because do you want somebody yelling at you where you're like, okay, I won't. But at the same time, they're like pointing out love handles and this and that. And it's like, you feel horrible about yourself at the end. So I love how you brought up the fact that it helps having an external set of eyes. And I think it also helps too, just having like data, because a lot of people get very caught up in how they feel during the process. It's like, well, I feel like I'm bigger today, or I feel heavier today, or I feel skinny today. And it's like, that's great and all, but the numbers don't say that, or they might, they might tell you, yes, you are making progress, or no, you're not making progress. So it's almost like people tend to rely on the wrong things.
Yeah. And I think in general, like a blend of subjective and objective is really helpful in terms of, you know, not being afraid of data and not being afraid to do things like weight and measurements at a frequency that like makes sense for you and your goals. But, you know, to also bring in the experiential thing is not, you know, because I think we boil down the experiential part of it too much to like, I'm feeling bigger today, or versus like energy, sleep, mood, you know, those are that those subjective experiential things that I think are much more helpful factoring in the equation versus like, oh, I feel bigger or smaller today, because, you know, that body image is so fluid that it can change, you know, for absolutely no reason. And for women, it can be related to the menstrual cycle and hormones as well. But sometimes for absolutely no reason, you're just going to be having a bad body image day. And having a coach to help you contextualize that is really helpful.
100%. Because I like how you said that you kind of have to just almost accept that it's going to happen, because it kind of gets into the idea of cognitive behavioral therapy, where it's like, this is just part of the experience. You're not going to all of a sudden wake up one day and be like, I feel fit as ever and I never have a bad day ever. Like, I think that it's almost like this unrealistic standard that people are trying to achieve. Would you agree?
Yes. Yes. Well, and in terms of like the, you know, the end result of, you know, my quote body, you know, composition journey or my body change journey, is that it's more of a before and during versus a before and after. I always tell clients that, you know, the journey keeps going once you lose weight. And when you think about, you know, weight loss versus weight maintenance and the number of days and weeks and months you're going to have in maintenance, just a numbers game is like, you're going to have a lot of bad days too. You're going to have probably more great days, but you're also going to have, even with training, there's going to be times where either you get injured or for no reason at all, you just don't feel like you're making progress. And
I'm glad you brought up training, because it's a very, very good parallel here. Like, you have those days where it's like, I'm literally just here to check the box. And that's a good chunk of days. And then there's days where you're like, I'm going to lift every weight in here.
Yes. It's like a bell curve. You're going to have a lot of mediocre days and then some fantastic days and some terrible days. And like, the longer you're maintaining and the longer you're consistent, you're going to see that bell curve versus every day just being like a party, you know, that it's just getting better and better all the time, which is, you know, sometimes how that weight loss journey is when people lose a lot of weight. And that is part of the transition to maintenance, is the rehabituating yourself to not getting dopamine from weight loss and from constantly making progress, but reframing like, how are you getting that positive feedback from yourself? Because the scale is really going to level out. So you need a different thing that gives you that yes moment.
Absolutely. And we're definitely going to get into that. But let's bring it back a little bit, because I know you said something really powerful before and I don't want to skip over it. How you were mentioning, it's like, you got to focus on things like sleep, stress, your energy improving and things like that. And I think that that gets glossed over when people start seeing numbers on the scale that they like and they're not reflecting on what got that number. And I know that some people are dead set on saying you got to count calories. You got to figure out exactly how many calories you're taking in. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I find myself in that camp a lot because I think it's very valuable finding that awareness. Mm-hmm. But that being said, for some people, it's just not right, or it's not a long-term strategy. What's your take on like calories, counting mm-hmm. them, and nutritional habits that you can implement that will mm-hmm. make it easier, or maybe make it so that you don't even have to count calories?
Yes. And the way I coach my clients is kind of a blend, because it partly depends on like whether someone is coming in from like very strict, you know, if they're using chronometer and weighing everything, their level of nutrition IQ is better than someone who isn't doing any tracking whatsoever. You know, then there's kind of more in the middle. If someone has been doing Weight Watchers for years, you know, something like Weight Watchers has a totally different perspective. So even what people think tracking is, you know, how that lives in your life could be different from person to person. And whenever I lost weight personally, I didn't do any tracking. For me, it was mostly, I would call it quality and quantity changes, where I was doing more around like portion control and cooking more, a lot of the basic kind of habits that I wasn't doing. But it was also because like my current diet was like a dumpster fire. So like anything different was better. And I think it is different when, you know, you're older, you know, have kids, if you have limited bandwidth issues. I think there are like more quote sophisticated nutrition strategies that do help, especially if you're already fairly health conscious. Sometimes it is something like calories and macros that takes it to the next level. So, but to, you know, clarify, whenever I first got like my personal training and fitness nutrition certifications, I was very all about macros in terms of like, you have to track, you do not know how much you're eating, you cannot know without tracking. And over time, like the way I practice actually has really evolved, because not for the reason that that statement is not correct, because in many ways it is. But what I find with a lot of people is that even when they're tracking, there's still just like too much noise to where they're not tracking accurately, or they're not in enough situations where accurate tracking is possible. And, you know, there's big accuracy issues, there's big inconsistency issues. And then there's some what I would call like missing the forest for the trees issues, where you're tracking, but the act of tracking is so cumbersome that it's distracting you from obvious things like eating more vegetables, eating more protein, because it's taking so long to figure out which salmon is it in the MyFitnessPal, you know, search, that you get sidetracked from like, it's just salmon, like just eat it, eat some vegetables, eat until you're not hungry anymore, you know, some of the basics. So I found over time that more and more of my clients benefit from a much more label reading, like not ignoring numbers, doing plenty of label reading, but getting away from tracking as like a full day model, and more of like a meal by meal, like how are you actually setting up each meal? And what I find for a lot of people is they might even get better results with doing that versus needing to track every single thing you eat.
Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense, because I mean, if we were to take it to the like total extreme, I use this example every once in a while, but when we go to like, say, bodybuilders, for example, the people mm-hmm. that usually do the best are the ones that are the most chill, that are like, yeah, I do mm-hmm. a little bit of this. Yeah, I do a little bit of that. And they're so in tune with how their body feels and what is necessary for them. They're not calculating every little thing, and their coach mm-hmm. is telling them just add a little here, add a little there. And because of that reduction in stress, their body actually ends up producing better results.
Yes. Like just the mental stress, I think yeah. we really underestimate, especially if someone, if there's a perfect storm of like, they're not very tech savvy, their nutrition IQ isn't very high, a lot of, you know, they have a stressful lifestyle where a lot of the foods aren't very trackable. It's just going to be frustrating for them. And they're probably not going to see good results from it, because, you know, and your listeners know, you will end up tracking the things that you feel in control of. And
exactly.
Whenever people do that, they often shrink down those meals even more, where they're taking like a perfectly fine, let's say 400 calorie breakfast, but because they can track it, they're making it even smaller and more perfect, you know, in big air quotes for the non-video listeners. And then there's these other glaring spots where they can't track, but if they don't have those soft skills around food, that's where literally all the calories are hiding. But meanwhile, they're even more predisposed to overeat at those times because they're running hungry from the other meals that are getting just tinier and leaner, you know, as time goes on.
Yeah, because if we're being honest, like, everybody knows what we should be eating. It's right. Like, we all kind of have an idea of, yes, like, what will get us in the right direction. The problem is the execution. So if we can figure out what that problem is, that usually opens up the door to progress.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it also depends on, like, what kind of challenges the person's facing. You know, is it someone who's a working mom or a stay-at-home mom? Those two things look really different in terms of what your food environment is actually going to be like. So, you know, I think that focusing more on meal composition helps people to not only be more thoughtful about, like, real nutrition IQ, which is like food groups and portion sizes, which sometimes tracking actually doesn't educate on. You know, you can end up learning how to track, but not actually absorb the fact that, like, rice and quinoa are pretty similar. You know, it just, they seem like such different foods until you start thinking of things more in groups. But it also, you know, it may not help people plan. And that was actually something that was, I don't know, a turning point for me in coaching was I would heavily advise clients, like, you really should use tracking in the morning to plan everything for the day and then see in advance, like, where you're going to run into problems. And I think that is, like, a really useful tool, but it did get me thinking, like, well, what if you just planned your day? You know, you don't necessarily, like, need to know all the numbers if you're just planning. And, you know, for most people, that can make a huge difference because it's just the action of thinking through. Even if the macros aren't perfect, just thinking through is what makes a radical improvement.
And it's interesting that you bring that up because a lot of times when we talk about success, like, success leaves clues. It's kind of like when professional athletes are so great, but they think it's because of this, like, random routine or this, like, superstition, like, that they have, but it's actually because they do the basics so well. And a lot of times with calorie counting, it's almost the exact same thing. People are like, yes, I'm hitting all these calories, which is true. It's going to have an effect on your body, but the big rocks are the planning. Are the decision fatigue being eliminated portions, because you're not stressed out when you're trying to make this food decision?
Yeah, like, not having to pick from the whole universe of foods, but just thinking, like, where on the plate, like, what's my starch? What's my protein? And I always tell people, you know, big veggie, where's the big veggie or the fruit? And then a little bit of fat. And of course, when you're dining out, it's like the quote rules are a little different because of the way the meals are composed, but, you know, those are the basics and you can really take those on the road and, you know, not be overly literal about it and it still have a huge effect on your body composition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, when it comes to I know we talked about a lot of nutrition stuff right there. When it comes to the training side of things, when you work with somebody who is, or let's go actually back to your journey. Like, I know that you are a mom of a very, very adorable daughter. Exactly did you do when you came back to fitness? Like, I know there's a lot of moms that are postpartum are very slow to get back because their bodies are either not letting them or their doctors have advised them no more than 10 pounds. What was your experience like with all of that?
Oh, it's so interesting you would bring that up. So I had kind of a unique experience in that even if I was projecting, like if I were planning my own postpartum experience over, it would be different because I also got pregnant during the pandemic. So, and I actually, it wasn't during, it was like right before. So it was just as, you know, that first trimester was ending, which is when most people, you know, surprise. And now it's like, that was the week literally that everything shut down. So, you know, that was the worst time. So I had no gym, no anything for like the entire pregnancy. And then even at the time, things were still super dicey in probably like the first 3 to 6 months of her life in terms of like the cultural norms were still like, everyone was masked everywhere. You didn't, do anything really extra. You went to like grocery stores and that was it. Like we didn't take, you know, her out to dine out or anything. So for me, my fitness journey was different just because my normal level of fitness actually decreased just because I was no longer training with a barbell. I wasn't training with heavier weights. All of a sudden it was like, I only had what I had at home. Like I had some free weights, I had some sliders, but I think in terms of what did go well that I would always advise people to do is that I stayed fit during pregnancy. So I walked tons, but then I also did do strength training. I, you know, used what I had at home. And then the same thing afterward. The main tip I would give to anyone postpartum is you really should see a pelvic floor physical therapist because they will help you in a personalized way build those foundations back for movement and for pelvic floor strength. But honestly, you know, what any pelvic floor PT would reinforce is a lot of walking and then, you know, just that gradual return to exercise. And then also I would say like not being in a total panic to lose all of the baby weight immediately is something else that I would advise because it's like having a major surgery or a major injury where you need a certain amount of calories to just recover, to do the new tissue formation that you need to do to have your pelvic floor strength come back, which will ultimately help you come back just fine and stronger and better than ever. But you can really shoot yourself in the foot by being like in a race with yourself to, you know, bounce back as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because it seems like the in thing is like these celebrities who have a baby and then mm-hmm. it's like a month later, it's like they look like they never had a baby and you're like, what the hell mm-hmm. happened? And they get right. praised for it. Meanwhile, most moms don't have that experience.
No. And I would say the most important thing to focus on is the return to exercise because there's so much focus on the weight loss part of it. And, you know, it's funny to go back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, it's not that you're not thinking about weight or that your head's in the sand and you're not thinking at all about nutrition or weight, but you know, where you put your focus is so important. And I think that building that strong foundation of a return to exercise and even more so like not waiting, because I think that's some of that gray area where, you know, you'll even get professional advice to not exercise in the first 6 weeks, or what they mean is like, don't go start training for a marathon. They don't mean, you know, like do bridges in your house, go for walks, do squats with your baby, like do start exercising almost right away. And then you'll be amazed at how much at that 6 week mark, the 12 week mark. And then of course there's a big plateau where then you improve very incrementally for like another 9 months. But then in about like 12 to 18 months, you really do, you're yourself again. You feel very, very normal. So if you can, you know, do the thing of, you know, what is it? Practice slow to progress fast.
Yeah. Slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
Yeah. Slow is smooth and smooth is fast. I couldn't remember what it is. Yeah. Like if you do that postpartum, the retrospective time goes by in the blink of an eye. Like you can't believe like once you're 12 to 18 months postpartum, it feels like no time. It's just on that front side of the time, it feels like a long time to think, oh, I have to wait that long to feel, you know, totally like myself, but it really does pass in the blink of an eye.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you said that because I think a lot of people think when their doctor says, hey, don't exercise for the first X amount of weeks or don't lift this mm-hmm. much weight. It's not because like they generally don't want you to exercise. It's what's called a CYA statement, cover your ass, which is basically they want to protect the people that are going to be dumb and are going to go run a marathon, the people that are going to go into a CrossFit class that are going to like burn the bridge and just destroy their body and end up back in the hospital.
Now, absolutely.
If you're following what your body's giving you, if you're getting those steps in and not going crazy, if you're lifting a lower percentage of the weights that you used to lift, like Claire Tia Toomey comes to mind because people were like losing their minds when she was lifting pregnant, but she was doing like 30% of what she's capable of.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. If you follow that protocol, you can get back to play or back to where your fitness levels were a lot faster without increasing injury risk.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and honestly, I've written a lot about the postpartum period in terms of exercise, and you know, the biggest risk for most people is not exercising. For most people, that's a much bigger deal, is that they're just not going to exercise at all. If you look at how many Americans are actually meeting physical activity standards, and then on top of that, like the actual challenges of the postpartum period to exercise, and then layer on all of the like body image and weight loss pressure. And often, you know, you have women who feel pressure to lose weight, but they're not doing any exercise at all. So even things like going for walks or lifting light weights would make a huge difference in someone's, I mean, short-term and long-term outcome. You don't even have to wait that long. And I know for me personally, it was, you know, like I was sort of one of those people where like a week or two later, like I kind of looked like myself. Like you wouldn't look at me and be like, oh, she just had a baby. But for me, like in terms of my fitness, it was that slow progression of like, I remember going back to the gym a few months after she was born. It was like, I couldn't do a single pull-up. And pre-pregnancy, I had been able to do pull-ups. And it was kind of crushing to feel like, you know, even though I had kept fit, that I had lost that strength. But then it was like, fast forward, had no problem rebuilding everything. Now it's like, I probably am literally stronger and faster than I was before.
Yeah. And one of the things that comes up a lot is the concept of muscle memory, because mm-hmm. we know it's a thing, but we don't necessarily have all the studies or whatever to show that, hey, this is why this happens or whatever. But mm-hmm. when you get back to doing things that you did prior, like muscle memory happens. It's easier to get back into shape than it is to get into shape in the first place.
Totally agree. Yes. Like those neural grooves are very important. And I think part of it too is like there's the neural grooves for movement, and you can be very literal about it in terms of like getting in the reps with exercise. But then there's also just those like habit neural grooves of getting in the reps of actually going to exercise, of doing the actions of like, what do you have to do to exercise? Get up earlier, lay out your clothes, you know, all that stuff, where even those neural grooves start working better if you do it more often. And ultimately, that's often what paves the path to success, is that habitual quality versus the like 0 to 60 time to get in shape, you know, yep. approach. So,
and I'm glad you brought up the whole concept of neural grooves too, because what people don't seem to realize is like the benefit of repeating workouts, the benefit of repeating exercises, mm-hmm. instead of doing these mm-hmm. group classes where you do new stuff all the time, over and over again. Mm-hmm. And that concept of building that neural bridge and learning the movements is so, so undervalued. Mm-hmm. So when you program Absolutely. For people, how often would you say that you change it up for them?
So typically what I do, I mean, I'm balancing like how technical I'm going to be in describing it. They're basically in 6-week cycles.
They're getting
fairly, yeah, it makes sense. You're getting fairly repetitive workouts, but I do it in like a week A, week B, week C wave. So you're not literally doing the same thing every time, but you're going to be seeing, you're going to be seeing a lot of the same stuff pop up over and over, where it's like every Monday looks pretty similar. Yes, there's some different exercises, but then after 6 weeks, you really hit refresh. And then there's those new A, B, and C waves of, you know, weeks of training that, again, like you're progressing the same movements, but things are advanced, things have maybe a little bit more variety. But I think people really underestimate that the variety is not terribly important, versus, you know, like the repetition, how do I say this? You want just enough variety to make it interesting enough for your personality to actually keep doing it, because you don't need that much variety from an exercise stimulus point of view. So, you know, you just want to make it enough, you know, interesting that you stick with it, basically.
Exactly. And to try and put a really weird attempt on an analogy here, I think a lot of people, when they are doing exercises, put it in perspective, it's kind of like they're barely squeezing the juice out of the orange. They're like figuring out what's the best mm-hmm. way to put my hand on this thing. And then by the time they figure that out, onto a new exercise. When if they repeat it, they would squeeze and get some juice out of it. And then next week, squeeze a little bit harder. And people just aren't getting the juice that they should from each exercise.
Yeah. And I also think it's the difference. And I talk about this with clients all the time, because like the demographic of clients that I work with, most of them love fitness classes. And so sometimes I help them like work that into their programming, because it's also important to enjoy the exercise you do. And if you don't like going to the gym and like having the headphones on and being by yourself, like if that's not motivating to you, I want you to do that. Like you're taking a vitamin like once or twice a week, like just do it. But then, you know, if it's more fun for you a few other times a week to go to a class, do it. But I help them understand the difference between like metabolic fatigue versus like an actual exercise stimulus that is going to change your body composition.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because I know so many people are like, I just want to sweat up a storm.
Yes. Yeah. I think a lot of people underestimate how strong they are. First of all, like, I think people are concerned about, I can't do heavier weights because I'm not experienced enough. And it is intimidating. If you're not with a trainer, you do have to overcome some internal discomfort around like figuring out how to do something by yourself, or feeling like more exposed, you know, that you're doing something on the weight floor. If you're a woman, you may be the only woman there, you know. And I think, you know, for my gym, it's like, then sometimes there will be just one in there. So it kind of depends, you know, on the day. It's not always that way. But it's so important, especially after you're over the age of 35 or 40, that you are going to start having sarcopenia. You are going to start losing muscle unless you start lifting heavier weights. And it doesn't mean that you have to compete for like a bodybuilding or a powerlifting competition, but you do need to start doing heavier resistance training for your body to actually get the message like, hey, she means business. You need to put on some muscle. And it, again, you don't need to be doing it five times a week. You can still mix in classes that you like. But the thing is, a lot of those classes, you may be holding weights, you may be using weights, but you are mostly doing cardiovascular exercise. It is maybe just what you would prefer to like running or something, but it is not really a replacement for actual strength training.
Absolutely. Because it really comes down to progression and lifting heavier over time. Mm-hmm. Because I know for anybody that hasn't checked out the previous podcast with Robert Linkle, he touched on the exact same thing, saying, if you want to be good to go in your 50s, you got to train in your 30s. Like if you want to be good to go in your 70s, you got to train in your 50s. It's about getting ahead of the game and doing the work so that that way you can get to the point where you want to be and not have to feel like you're starting at square one when it's already a problem.
Well, because that process does accelerate, you know, it just starts when you're in your 30s and then it picks up speed as you age. And then, you know, around 60 or around menopause, then it really starts picking up. So it's better if you can stay ahead of it. That being said, there's plenty of people who don't start early enough, but you know, you can even do things like reverse changes in bone density after menopause with strength training. So it's also like the future is bright if you start, like the right time is now, regardless of how old you are. But yeah, just being, to tie back to what you were saying about strength training, that people often equate being out of breath with a good workout. And I often will clarify with people that you may not actually feel out of breath from effective strength training, and that, you know, out of breath is a cardiovascular thing. It's not a strength training thing, and that you can have a great workout and not even break a sweat, because it's about what your body is doing in the next 2 to 3 days, not how much you gave on the gym floor.
And to bring it full circle, it's not about how you're feeling. It's about the numbers and how we're producing and what your body is giving you.
Yes. And I think being more methodical, just to, you know, tie in the consistency thing as well, is the problem is you can't be methodical if you're not consistent. And so that consistency piece is so important, whether we're talking about nutrition or training, that if what you have is a bunch of random things, you can't see patterns. Like you don't know exactly what the person is doing. And that's why, like in my coaching, I will always tell clients that, you know, the exercise is a non-negotiable. in terms of like, we will collaborate on what's the best frequency for you, what's actually going to work. Are you more of like a 20 minutes at home or an hour at the gym kind of person? You know, the specifics aren't so important. But then once we decide on it, you have to do it. Because if you don't do the exercise, there's many, many reasons that you're not putting that cascade of positive effects into motion, where then we can start progressing things, we can start seeing that change in body composition. So, you know, I think, you know, related to the macros conversation, there's so much emphasis on nutrition with weight loss that when we're, you know, building for sustainability, we want to make sure that exercise is actually like at the front of the picture, because this is what the person's going to be doing to also keep weight off after they lose it. So building that like really robust consistency is so important. And that in some ways, nutrition can almost be, quote, messier than people think. And it goes fine, you know, overall, like the net of how the pattern emerges is fine, as long as exercise is in a good place. So coming from, you know, a more exercise forward point of view can help to put nutrition in context too, in terms of perfectionism.
Absolutely. And the fact that when they actually survey people who have lost weight for a long time and kept it off, and almost all of them exercise, it makes you wonder when you see weight loss clinics or these scam like supplement companies mm-hmm. saying, lose weight without exercise. It's like, do they really have your best interest at heart?
Right. Well, and I think the hard thing is that it's just true that like most people don't like exercise. And, you know, to take it a step further, that it's hard work and people don't have a lot of bandwidth. So yeah. Even for people who like exercise, there's not a lot of bandwidth to fit it into your day. And I think that's where choosing like sustainable strategies that you really can adhere to is so important, versus the I'm in weight loss mode, so I'm going to go as hard as I can for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days or whatever it is. But more so, I think it's better to come up with something that feels more achievable right away, because yeah. you're going to keep doing it. You know, you need to pick something that you can stick with.
And I think also a lot of people have never really experienced what a good workout feels like, where you mm-hmm. feel better when you walk out than when you walked in. Because yeah. with mm-hmm. this group style, with like a lot of the programs that are out there, they're trying to get you to feel like you did something and feel like you're exhausted. Mm-hmm. But you can get really good results by doing strength training and pushing hard for a set, resting a minute or two, pushing mm-hmm. hard, resting a minute or two. And then you leave where you're mm-hmm. like, all right, I feel my muscles working and I feel like I could tackle the day. That was pretty easy. I feel like I have more to give, but people have never really experienced that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is what you just described is how many people, especially towards the beginning of programs where they do that, and they're like, it really wasn't that hard. And then the next day they're like, so sore.
Yep.
Clearly like something was working. It didn't feel like
as coaches were like, oh boy, here it comes. Just wait.
Yeah. I really try and manage that for clients, because you don't want to be so sore that you can't move the next day. But it's interesting what you brought up, that it's sometimes that's a friction with me and my clients, is that they'll say, I didn't really want to wait for the 1 or 2 minutes. So I just did it again. And that is my immediate response, is like, you're not using heavy enough weights. Like if you yep. don't have to wait for 1 to 3 minutes, like you are not training at a high level of intensity. And, yep. you know, it takes time to find that too. Like sometimes, like we were talking about those neural pathways, it takes time for everything to come online. But especially when people are at the beginning of their journey, for upper body, they can probably do 10 to 20 more pounds than they think. And sometimes for lower body, you could do probably 20 to like 80 more pounds than you think. It's a huge percentage of difference of yep. what you could actually do.
Yeah. I know where I used to work at, we had two sections. We had a turf section and then like a weight section. And on the mm-hmm. turf, we ran these group style classes, which were more cardio based, kind of like this stereotypical like group class. And then on the other side, it was more small group, like lifting heavier, taking the proper time. Mm-hmm. And people would literally go to the turf side and be doing deadlifts with like 22, 35 pounds. Mm-hmm. And then they go to the other side the day after and lift 100 pounds. And you're just like, mm-hmm. huh.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. you're a little stronger than you think you are. And they're like, yeah, it's easier when I'm not out of breath.
Yeah. Don't chase the burn.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very important in terms of actually doing something sustainable and like in an area where the results speak for themselves. And that's the thing, is you have to be patient that, like, you will probably have more of that buy-in once you see the scale start to go down or your measurements start to go down. But it might take 2 or 3 weeks for that to happen. Yeah. So, you know, you have to stick with it for a few weeks and let things start to really change your body.
I'm glad you brought up the measurements, because that's a big thing that is repeated on this podcast too, because honestly, some people will respond really, really well to strength training to the point where they're putting on muscle and burning fat mm-hmm. almost at the exact same time, to the point where the scale does not budge. Now, mm-hmm. how do you like to navigate that when somebody's like, this scale isn't doing anything? My clothes fit better, but what the hell?
Yes. Well, and it definitely depends, because the measurements are providing this really key piece of information, because I do have clients like that where they're really hypertrophic. So they are picking up weights and they're putting on muscle. But I have a client like this right now. In the last, I think it's a month and a half, maybe, she's lost like 2 inches off her waist, but she's only lost like 3 pounds on average. But, you know, when you run the numbers, it was something like, you know, she had probably lost 8 pounds of fat and had gained 5 pounds of muscle, which is, you know, it's an estimate. That would be like super fast muscle gain, so it's probably a little off, but the measurements tell a huge story about what's happening behind the scenes, where if your deficit isn't huge, and that's the other thing, is like, if you're in a deficit, you're definitely going to lose weight. So just for clarity, like, if you're not losing weight, you're not in a deficit. But I also think that when people hear that, they hear it as like a challenge of like, oh, like, I should get in a deficit. And then it's like, wait, hold on. Because if you're losing inches, it's not necessarily a bad thing that you're not in a deficit, because your body's doing a really good job of taking all of the resources you're bringing in, including probably a higher protein diet if you're working with a coach. So it's doing a much better job of marshaling its resources, building muscle, burning fat. And ultimately, if what you want to do is like be leaner and look better, then you don't have to worry as much about the scale. And even for myself, you know, I tell people that initially I lost 50 pounds. Technically, I've kept off about 40, but that's because I introduced strength training in there somewhere. And early in my weight loss journey, I was technically like lighter and smaller than I am now by like a small amount. But I could not hang in like any fitness class. Like, I would just be like dead. I mean, I could go to like a bar class and I just would be ready to like throw up. Like, my endurance and my strength was like so poor. And now I feel like I can go to anything and be fine, you know, by any standard. I'm very strong, but it's like, I have this one dress that I've had for 10 years and it's like, I still fit in it. So like, wherever that 10 pounds went, wasn't anywhere that, you know, I don't like.
Yep.
So, you know, I think it's very important to remember that, you know, the scale is just one data point. It's a very meaningful data point, but it only makes sense in context. If you're also doing measurements, you're also doing photos, you're sensing how your clothes are fitting. And then again, like you said, getting out of that, I feel big or I feel fluffy, up and down body image, but actually like giving yourself enough time to establish trends of like, on average, this is how I feel.
Yeah. And there's a saying in our space where it's like, your dream body is most likely heavier than you think it is.
It's true. Mm-hmm.
And I know that one of the really good examples I heard, I'm not sure how not legal, but I'm not sure how great the message was on this, but have you heard of Mind Pump, the podcast?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the head guys, Sal, used to be a head trainer, and he had a thing where when people would come in and they were like hyper fixated on like, I need to hit this amount of weight, I need to be this body weight. Mm-hmm. They would bring in one of the female trainers and be like, listen, if you can guess her weight, you get a year free of membership. And not a single person got a free mm-hmm. year, because she was a small petite girl and they're like, oh, she probably weighs mm-hmm. 110, 120. She was like 145.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because she
and
had
a lot
muscle.
Of women have numbers in their head. And, you know, you even hear like offhanded remarks about it in movies where there will be like jokes about women's weight. And it's like, there is an acceptable weight range for women that's like somewhere between 110 and 120 pounds, regardless of your height. regardless of your build, like that is the right weight for women to be if you just kind of absorb cultural messaging. And, mm-hmm. you know, the truth is, like, if you're over 5'5", if, you know, under many different circumstances, even if you're shorter, there might be a higher weight that is like the right weight for you with strength training, where like you look good, you like how you like your clothes, but you are not as light as you thought you would be.
And I'm glad you brought up movies because it made me think of Encanto. Have you ever seen that Disney movie?
Oh, only 100 times.
Oh, yeah. But you know, the really like jacked sister. And when the toys came out, when the toys came out, it was interesting because there's like the stereotypical like flower power, like skinnier, like all about beauty girl that had her action figure. And then there was the really strong one who like had really big, strong arms and could lift mountains. And which one did the little girls prefer? The one that was stronger.
Okay,
the one that was stronger sold so many more units.
Yes. My daughter is obsessed with that character. Her name is Louisa. And it's funny because she's literally like saving her pennies to buy a Louisa costume.
That's awesome.
And she does things like she goes around the house with like the couch pillows and like throws them.
That is so awesome.
And she, like, her song is her favorite song. Like, yes, I mean, giving those good examples. And I mean, that's a whole other topic, is the idea of, you know, when you're dieting, when you're losing weight, like if you have children, because I know that your main audience is moms, is like, what messages are you giving to your kids about weight and about like your own body and what is that transmitting to them? It's so powerful too. And I absolutely love hearing that Louisa was the more popular, because I didn't know that story. I thought maybe it was just my daughter. That's so funny.
Well, because I think it's ingrained in us that everybody wants to be that person that could lift mountains, that is strong, that like is useful, that people look up to. And I think that unfortunately, a lot of people grew up in an era where it's like heroin chic or
thin was in.
Yeah, thin being in. And it just twisted how we naturally think about things, where it's like, oh, no, this is what society wants. So I got to get smaller, 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 instead of I want to get stronger and be a badass version of myself, instead of just fading away and not taking up space.
And I definitely think that's more of an issue if you're over 35, over 40, if you're like more like an older millennial or Generation X, that, you know, we did grow up at that time whenever thin was super in. And I think the messaging is, I'm not saying there's not problematic messaging now, but it's so much more diverse. It's just those negative messages are just one voice among many examples, versus I think there was a much more overriding cultural message, like when I was growing up, where there was one way to be beautiful, and if you didn't fit it, like, that was it, you're out. Good luck.
And I know that especially in gyms now, it's so much more common to see women on the powerlifting platforms and lifting the dumbbells and lifting the barbells. And just know, anybody listening, the people that actually like are in there consistently, that are putting in the hard work, the gym rats appreciate the hell out of you. Like, they love seeing
they're the nicest people. Yes, they're gonna support you
100%, because I know, at least personally, I go in and I see somebody squatting a bunch or like doing their like pressing their dumbbells and stuff, and they're grinding it out, pushing hard. I'm like, hell yes, this is what real gym rats love, the hyper masculine teeny beanie babies that can't be bothered to like lift more than 30 pounds, and they feel like they're inadequate. Those guys might have a problem with it, but most of the rest of us that are not judging you will love you for it.
Yes. And there's also no point in comparing yourself, because I hear that a lot in terms of, oh, well, you know, I'm going to be lifting so much less, or if it comes to weight, like, I don't look as good as that person. Like, I'm intimidated by like being in the same space as this other person who you're saying, you know, in context, like that they deserve to be there more than you. And, you know, it is a gym, like people are going to work on themselves, you know, like everyone is allowed to go to work on themselves. It is not a performative space.
Yes.
And yes, like people, you might make eye contact with someone, or, you know, like there is a social aspect to it, but to not assume that people are judging you and they're, you know, they're thinking you shouldn't be there. It's just not true.
Because if we're being honest, everybody's thinking, oh my God, everybody's judging me, to the point where nobody's judging anybody. It's just this giant circle of people that are like, oh my God,
everyone's looking at themselves in the mirror. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yep. Everybody's focused on number one. Don't let it distract you. And the people that have time to give a crap about anybody else usually need more going on in their life. So we don't give them any attention.
Yeah. And I wrote, I contributed to an article a while back about shy girl workouts. That was a TikTok trend.
What is that?
Okay. So the idea is, and it's true that like some women and men too, I shouldn't say just women, but you know, it's so self-conscious when you go to the gym, sometimes the way gyms are set up is very unfriendly in terms of like, I have an example in my gym of like, there's three different places that there are pull-up bars. I only use two of them because one of them would require me to be literally in the center of the weight room, have to get a box to like jump off of, you know, it's just not set up in a friendly way to me, like physically. And so I would feel super exposed and self-conscious using that piece of equipment. So for me, I'm going to use the other two pull-up bars. So the idea being that if you do feel more shy and self-conscious, like you can still get everything done probably if you just get clever about setting up like your workout spaces so that you feel like you're in a safe spot. And for some people, that's going to mean like using machines more because machines feel a little more private usually than like a barbell area. And it's that idea of, you know, you don't have to like live or die by any one specific exercise, but more so like just resistance training is resistance training. So you do it in the way that you're comfortable. And then often the more you work on it, your comfort zone actually does get bigger. Where if you've been like killing it on the leg press, it's not that hard to make that transition to barbell training.
Absolutely. That's one of the best ways to get yourself in the gym is just stick to the machines. Like they tell you exactly what it works out. Feel what that muscle feels like when it's doing its job and start from there. There's no right or wrong way to start.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Actually, I'll take that back. The wrong way to start is to beat yourself up, like we talked about before, to the point where you can't walk and you're debilitated.
there's a lot of wrong ways to start, but also your journey might be bumpy too. You know, sometimes it's school of hard knocks with working out.
Yes. It's not going to be perfect. And we want to make that very clear because so many people expect nutrition, fitness to be this thing where it's like it just clicks and all of a sudden everything is working perfectly and you're an expert on day one. Treat it like a college class. Get your syllabus, figure out what the heck's going on and take it class by class, week by week.
Mm-hmm. Your mindset may click right away, but often there's tons of troubleshooting. Because you will do a lot of overshooting and undershooting. And a lot of it is like a boat navigating how they're constantly tacking. You will do a lot of that in like a long-term health and fitness journey because you just can't help it. You're going to underdo and overdo things. But as long as that average journey is always like kind of sneaking forward in the right direction, you'll be fine.
Very well said. Now, I want to be respectful of your time. I know that we're coming up on the hour. Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah, I do.
Cool. Because we always end with a question that the previous guest left for the future guest.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I'll get your question when we're off air. So to leave everybody in suspense, but your question from the previous guest, Robert Linkle, is if you could have this level of expertise in a different field, what would it be?
Oh, I would love to be fluent in another language.
Oh, really?
Yes, that is the first thing that pops into my head. And it's not impossible. And I think if I were to like take my own advice around things, it would be like start small, you know, take a course, do Babbel, like literally do anything, but start, you know, just being consistent. But I would love to be proficient in another language.
That's pretty cool. What would be the first language you start on?
Well, you know, it's funny. We love Italy. So I would love to become fluent in Italian, but I actually took French in school. So it's probably a shorter leap with French. But yeah, probably be one of those.
Gotcha. Yeah, I took Spanish and they were basically like, it kind of feeds into everything. You'll figure it out. There's similarities. So hopefully, well, you could get to that point, right? Babbel enough and you'll get there.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that was a great way to end it. Thank you so much for coming on. Now, if people are listening and they're like, I love what Rachel's saying. I want to see more of her stuff. Where can they find you?
You can find me at my website, which is just racheltrotta.com, or I'm on Instagram at racheltrottacpt.
Awesome. And that's going to be in the show notes, guys. So you don't have to go anywhere. Just go down, click away. And as a thank you for listening in and Rachel doing her thing and leaving us so much good stuff, if you guys have some part of this podcast where you're like, oh my God, that is exactly what this person needs in my life, that one person, you know, you got them on your mind, go ahead and send this episode to them and be like, you got to listen to what Rachel said. This is going to help you out so, so much. Okay. And they'll love you for it. We'll love you for it, for sharing the podcast. So thank you in advance. Other than that, hope everybody has an amazing rest of their week. I'll see you guys next time. Until then, go kick some ass. See you later.